Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I am Al Warren. And we got Mr. John Copenhaver here again, double time this week.
No, I came back for more. It's amazing.
You can't get enough.
I can't.
Yeah, that's what people say, you know. I just can't get enough of me, you know. And so big outright this weekend, hey? You excited?
Yeah, I am. We got a good program set up. You're going to be on one of the shows, and we've got another panel of crime writers. Outright is something that's been growing over the years. For those of you who may not know, it's a online conference out of Washington, D.C. for LGBTQ writers. But we have, you know, I like to bring some crime to the whole thing, not literally, but fictionally, and I guess true crime now. But I'm super excited about it. I think it's going to be a cool event.
Yeah, it should turn out all right until I get up, and then and everybody will be like, oh my God,
we'll be fine.
No, they'll be offended. I always do that, you know. Now, speaking of offended, we've got a great writer here, Mr. Rob Osler. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Rob, so you've got a book out called Devil's Chew Toy, a novel. I like that name. So tell me, what's the basic premise of this book?
The basic premise of the book is a mild-mannered gay ginger protagonist goes out regular night, Friday night, goes to the dance club, works up for him what is like a bold move is to tip a go-go boy. Again, I stress he's mild-mannered. That simple, fairly innocent act unleashes a number of improbable events and kind of sets his whole life on a different course. And really, that's kind of the inciting incident is just an innocent act at a gay bar, and mayhem ensues.
So are you, when you write that book, are you the go-go boy in this, or are you part of one of the main characters?
Oh, great question. No, I really identify with Hayden, our mild-mannered, you know, ginger pocket gay, if you're familiar with that term. You know, he's just so cute and adorable, I could put him in my pocket. He's about, as he described himself, he's 5'4", rounding up, and 130 pounds, also rounding up. So, you know, he's a fairly small guy. He also has a blog on the side called Mates on Dates, which is his, you know, gay relationship blog, which is kind of ironic because he has no relationship. It's the conduit through which he really speaks directly to his readers, all 12 of them, about, you know, the ups and downs of, you know, wading the gay dating waters.
Hmm. So, you based this in Seattle, right?
I did. I lived in Seattle for about 17 years. I kind of describe Seattle as my spirit city. You know, people have their spirit animals. It's kind of my spirit city. It's, you know, it rains all the time. It's kind of Neil Young weather, as I describe it. And so, yeah, so I set the book there because, you know, anybody who's ever written a novel, you know, it's a lot of time you spend with the characters in that setting. And that's kind of where I wanted to return when I was writing the book. So I get to, you know, follow along with the crazy characters as they, you know, in their mad romp across Seattle from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Yeah, up on Capitol Hill, you know.
Yeah, they go from Capitol Hill to Ballard. He actually, Hayden, the star of the show, he lives at in West Seattle, where I also lived at one point, although I never lived in his apartment complex called the Orca Arms. There's a lot of good action that happens at Orca Arms as well as all other parts of the city.
I bet. Seattle itself, do you actually make it a character in a way?
I do in a way. I mean, it's certainly a pretty dominant backdrop because I describe, hopefully not over-describe, but, you know, I try to put the reader in the variety of neighborhoods because West Seattle has its own flavor. Finney Ridge, where his evangelical aunt and his 91-year-old friend Jerry live in their you know, townhomes. To Festers, which is the video arcade. In the university district, shorthanded, you know, by those who know as the U district. So I do try to kind of like paint that picture of Seattle because each neighborhood is really so distinctive. And I know them well. And, you know, it also made it pretty easy. It was both enjoyable for me to return to those places, but it also made it, you know, easier to write because I didn't have to do a lot of research. You know, I've been to those places. You know, I know where the bridges are. I know, you know, the ferry schedule and what it's like to cross, you know, to Bainbridge Island and all of that. So hopefully the reader can go along for a pretty immersive Seattle experience, you know, across 300 pages with Hayden and Hollister in their pacing prompt.
Did you mention Queen Anne?
I don't think I do. Oh, but no. I know that's such a kind of heralded neighborhood, but hopefully there'll be other books in the series. So I'm sure he'll have a reason to crawl up the hill at one point.
So when you start a book like this and you start putting it together, is it a storyline that comes to you first, or is it the character or one or two characters that come to you first?
Yeah. You know, there are three things that have never changed, but only three things. The title, which you mentioned early on, Devil's Chew Toy. The main character, Hayden McCall, and I had an idea of, you know, what he was like in terms of personality and his interest, as well as his physical description. And then the inciting incident, which you know, we've already talked about, which is that, you know, innocent, you know, I'm going to tip the go-go boy at the gay bar as the inciting incident. Those were the only three things that kind of stood the test of time. Everything else in the book changed. The one thing that I intended to do, and, you know, hopefully I'm reasonably successful at it, is I liked this notion of, again, that innocent incident setting off this crazy, unexpected, almost surreal and awkward series of kind of life-threatening situations. And for that, I'm going to go way back. Do either of you remember this is a Martin Scorsese film, but one that I think is often forgotten, After Hours. Do you guys remember that movie?
The name is familiar.
Yeah, I know the name. I have never seen it, though. Did you recommend it?
Yeah, it's such a goodie. 1985, so it's going back a ways, but stars Griffin Dunne, Rosanna Arquette, Terry Garr, and, wait for it, the incomparable Catherine O'Hara.
Oh.
Yeah, she so now I got your interest. So but the setup for the movie was just so brilliant. The main character, Griffin Dunn, you know, he works, I think, like as a computer programmer or a data input person, really boring job. Not that all computer programming jobs are boring. He just happened to have a boring variety of that job. And after work, he goes to run this fairly innocent incident and he loses his money. And that simple thing triggers this crazy series of events. And then throughout the next, 12 hours, all he's trying to do is escape these crazy people that he keeps running into and get back home in Manhattan. And I just love that idea that, you know, you can set out on what is like a mundane, you know, seemingly routine errand, and your life completely is turned upside down and you're set off on this crazy adventure that no one would ever believe in the retelling. And so that spirit of that idea is really what helped shape the plot in Devil's Chew Toy. It's just, of course, it's a completely different story, but I liked that dynamic of the unexpected, unpredictable, crazy events.
So the name, where'd the name come from?
I don't even remember at this point. I liked the notion of, well, actually, there was a character in a version of this story years ago at this point. That character has been, killed from the book long ago. But he was a very evangelical dude. And so he actually was a villain in the story. I don't want to waste too much time in like telling you the story that went away, but to answer that, like, where did the Devil's Chew Toy come from? I was playing with that tension of, you know, he's a good Christian by day, but if you saw what he did when people weren't looking, he's really a bad guy. And he's internally tormented by these two different people that he's trying to compartmentalize in his head. And I was like, yeah, he's like, it's like if the devil had a chew toy, that's this guy, right? Because he's tormented. So it's essentially, I also like playing, you know, with themes of religion and morality and, you know, really what is a good Christian versus, you know, not a good Christian, not that I'm a religious person at all. But anyway, that hopefully there's an answer tucked in there somewhere. But that was kind of the idea of of where the title came from. And then, frankly, I was so smitten with the title that as the book changed so much over the years, I just wanted to stick with the title. And so, you know, the savvy reader, or maybe not even, it doesn't, might not even take the savvy reader to see. It's like, oh, I see how you kind of shoehorned in a reason for the title, you know, page 250 of the 300 plus page novel where one of the characters, Jerry, the 91-year-old friend to Hayden, the main character, you know, explains this notion of the Devil's Chew Toy in a more eloquent way than I just described it, but hopefully makes reason for, you know, why that title is, that label is relevant to the story.
So why do you center things around or have them involved, I guess, religion?
I was raised by an evangelical parent. Yeah, so I can remember many a Saturday being dragged to the big hotel. I was born and raised in Boise, Idaho, I should mention. Oh. And at the Roadway Inn, that was like the four story, you know, biggest hotel in town. And there would be like an all-day Saturday evangelical event where a pastor would come in from out of town, and you know, and you would spend the day there in prayer and Bible study and song and the things one does at an all-day Saturday evangelical Bible event. And mind you, you know, at the time, this is like, you know, I'm in sixth through, you know, seventh, eighth, ninth grade until, you know, I finally rebelled. And it's like, I'm not doing it anymore. So you can imagine, you know, there were other ways that a young teenager would like to spend his weekends than doing that. But, you know, having close family members who are still, you know, involved in that faith, who those sets of beliefs, you know, largely define who they are and shape their world is really very fascinating to me, because I've lived that experience, not for many decades, but I've lived that experience in my past. And now to be on the outside looking in, and today, you know, when we reflect on, you know, all of the different, you know, legislation and what's going on in America and divisiveness and red versus blue and just all of that stuff that definitely has, you know, like a religious component. You know, when we talked about like Christian nationalism and that kind of thing, I find it interesting. You know, I mean, in many ways it's discouraging, but I find those tensions that human beings can, you know, basically just believe things based on a yearning to believe versus science. And it doesn't get more fascinating to me, you know, than human being and psyche than those sorts of issues.
Do you have a point to it? Like, are you just trying to relate an experience of being religious, or are you trying to point out something?
Yeah, I'm not trying to make a statement. I really appreciate that question. I think more than anything, I'm trying to acknowledge that is the world. That's an element in which Hayden, that's an element of the world in which Hayden exists, because his aunt, his mother passes away. I don't think I'm giving away too much of the book, but his mother passed away when he was in high school. So he was then raised by his aunt, who's really only, you know, immediate family. Well, she's evangelical. And so, you know, he loves her and he respects her, but, you know, he doesn't agree with with her thinking. Conversely, she loves him. He's family, but she does not in any way understand, you know, a person's being gay, let alone, you know, does she, you know, she doesn't accept his being gay, but yet she accepts him. And I think it's just, and I don't go deep on this, you know, I do describe their relationship in the book. But, you know, I didn't want to go, you know, deeply into that because it's supposed to be a fun adventure. But I try to keep it real in a sense that it's like, you know, this is a part of his world, and it's complicated, and his feelings for her are complicated because of what she believes. And so it's the second time I've used this word compartmentalize, but, you know, they compartmentalize these pieces of themselves when they interact with each other so they can get along and just try to focus on, you know, what they share, which is, you know, family. And they do love each other, even though, you know, they can't possibly, you know, accept, you know, he can't accept her evangelical beliefs any more than she can really truly accept his being gay. I just find that, you know, interesting, because life's complex.
Mm. How do you experience these characters? Like, are you seeing them visually? Do you hear the voices? Do you, what experience do you go through when you're working with these characters to do the book?
Yeah, it's really vivid to me. I can see them. I can hear them. I am literally standing. I'm in the room with them. I can picture, you know, Burley, who's, you know, literally a physical giant with her, you know, Willie Nelson pigtails and her cowboy boots and her jean cutoffs. I can picture her.
Sounds like John.
With the pigtails, if you only had pigtails.
If only I had enough hair, Al, to have pigtails.
It's, you know, and before I've gotten the questions, it's always interesting. It's like, you know, who would play these characters, you know, if we were ever so lucky to, like, have them, you know, turned into a movie. And I can never come up with anybody because they're so, they're so distinctive as like individual human beings that I can't like put another face on them. The only one I can think of is like Della Rupert, who is the kind of creepy proprietress of Barkingham Palace, the marvel of a boutique of a pet store in Ballard, speaking of neighborhoods in Seattle. And I could picture her being played by like Melissa McCarthy, you know, with her 70s big, you know, gold rim, eyeglasses and her floral muumuus and her, you know, overpowering perfume of lilac. I can see like all of the characters tend to be pretty over the top. And so she's the only one that I can picture like a movie star inhabiting that character. Everybody else is really very distinctive to me.
Hmm. Do they sort of have control over their own destiny, or is this something you completely control?
I would say Hayden, I kind of control him, and the characters, I do myself a disservice. You know, I'm sure that you know everybody's heard these terms, you know, like plotter versus planner. And pantser, plotter versus pantser, like fly by the seat of your pants. I definitely am err on the side of flying in the seat of your pants, because I let the characters just kind of do these crazy things, and sometimes it kind of works me into a corner where I'm like, well, that's not going to work in terms of the arc of the story, or that scene just kind of takes over too much of the story and becomes too big. But I definitely, again, I kind of ride alongside Hayden and he's my alter ego in the stories. And so when he interacts with Hollister, I kind of go into those chapters wondering, wow, I wonder what Hollister's going to do and to entertain us and take us out of our comfort zone, because I definitely am a shyer person. I'm not very bold. Again, I relate a lot to Hayden. He says at one point, one of the reasons why he really likes Hollister is, you know, she's got such a big, bold personality that, you know, they balance each other out. You know, he likes that because he doesn't have to be the star of the show. She is the star of the show. So he gets to just, you know, ride along beside her and be largely entertained by her. And that's the way I view Hollister and Burley and Della Rupert and Roy Driggs, these other secondary characters. I try to set them up and create them where they can be big and larger than life and have a distinct personality in my head, and then just kind of let them roll and then rein them back when I need to because of plot points or arcs or that kind of thing.
So I'm just curious, I'm not sure. Did you set out to write Devil's Chew Toy and thinking, I want to write a cozy or a quozy? or did it just sort of that felt like the right, you know, you wrote the story and it felt like that was the right sort of, I guess, you know, way of labeling it or marketing it? I'm just curious. And if you did you feel that there was, that were there ever uneasy sort of moments with this sort of label of cozy? I'm just curious.
No, all of the above. I'll tell you that it wasn't the first time I ever heard cozy associated with this book. So sorry, let me rewind and say, no, it was not my intention to write a cozy with, you know, gay and lesbian protagonists. What was my intention for sure out of the gate was I didn't want the gays to be tragic victims, and I didn't want them to be the villains. Moreover, I wanted them to be largely nice to each other. I wanted friendship to be at the heart of the book. I'll bring up, this is, you know, there's no better time to bring up Armistead Maupin at this point. It's like, you know, his Tales of the City, which first came out in 1978, of course, there was like 9 of those novels in the series. What is beloved to me about those books is the friendships among, you know, Michael Tolliver, who was the San Francisco gay guy, Marianne Singleton, fresh from the Midwest, who's straight, and then Anna Madrigal, you know, who turns out to be, you know, a trans woman, landlady on, Barbary Lane here in San Francisco. And I loved the fact that it was a story that was filled with gay characters, that had lots of, you know, gay themes and gay related settings, but the characters weren't necessarily, you know, vicious to each other, the gay characters, and they weren't always the villains, and it was about friendship. So that's kind of like the sensibility that I had going in. It wasn't until my editor of the book, who I adore, by the way, Sarah J. Henry, said, well, you know, this is a gay cozy. And I'm like, really? Ben Leroy, also at the publisher, who was the acquisitions editor, he said, well, I don't know if it's a cozy. I call it cozy adjacent. And I'm like, all right, well, either way, it's like cozy. And, you know, and honestly, since then, you know, I'm like, okay, well, you know, a cozy, the main elements, you know, to know that you've got a cozy, or, you know, you don't have profanity, you don't have sex. If you do have sex, it's alluded to, it's off the page. And, you know, you don't have violence. There's usually a murder, but again, it usually, you know, happens off the page. You know, made famous by, you know, a lot of the Miss Marple, Agatha Christie novels where, you know, the vicar is found in the rose bush. You know, that's kind of like, oh, you probably have a cozy on your hands. And then I think of like Katrina McPherson, who is, you know, very dear to me and wrote the cover blurb kindly on the book. And, you know, at one point she was describing cozies as, you know, sometimes they get so sweet, the cupcake is the killer. And I love that.
So, yeah, she's awesome.
She's so awesome. So that I relay that little quote quip because I do sometimes get uncomfortable with cozy. I'm not bashing cozies at all because, well done, you know, they can be as entertaining and well crafted as any other genre or subgenre of fiction. But, you know, I didn't set out to write that. And sometimes they can be, not all of them, and they're not defined by being too sweet, but I didn't want to make it too sweet. And it kind of goes back to your question, Al, about, you know, these elements of religion or trying to keep it real. You know, because Camillo, the go-go boy, is also a dreamer, right? So I throw that in there to keep it real, that life is messy, and I didn't want it to just be too saccharine sweet a story.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Living in this, you know, in this kind of sanitized world, but at the same time doing the balance with, you know, not going too deep on any issues like Hollister being a Black, you know, lesbian, you know, woman in America and not trusting that the police are going to do everything they can to find Camilo. You know, that's her story to tell, and that's probably a very valid, legit belief she has. But I'm going to stop short of going deep into, you know, a Black woman's experience in America, because that, you know, hardly is that my story to tell.
It's fascinating because I think cozies are, you know, I don't write in that sort of subgenre myself, but I know that there's been a lot of, they can be very actually wonderful at addressing, you know, difficult social issues, but making them sort of accessible to a fairly wide audience. That's just fascinating to me. But sometimes they sound really limiting, right? Because of all the rules, you know. Yeah. I'm like, mystery fiction has a lot of rules already. So, but I, you know, it does. I feel that balance is hard to strike. So I think, you know, but understandable that you. It sounds like you've done that, and so. That's a cool thing. Do you want to continue with this series, or you want to go a different direction, or what's on your mind about that?
Yeah, I have a second book in the series sitting with Sarah, the editor. So I'm hopeful that, you know, that will be a go soon, because I really like the characters. It's probably important for an author to actually like their characters. So I do. And so I've got lots of stories and adventures that I'd like to take them on. I've got another historical series. As I mentioned early on, I was born and raised in, you know, places of Boise, Idaho. And I came across a plaque of this building called the Natatorium, which was built in the late 1800s, which was like the largest indoor swimming facility in the world. And it was in Boise, Idaho. It was it's like a Moorish cathedral to indoor swimming with naturally, you know, heated geothermal heating of the water. And I just remember looking at the plaque. It blew down in a windstorm in like 1936. It stood for like 45 years. And I thought, wow, that is one spooky looking building. And in the early 1900s, that would be a great setting for a murder mystery. So I created a character, Harriet, who travels to Boise from Chicago. She's a private detective with a Prescott agency, which is fictional, but there were female detectives at the time, very few of them in New York and in Chicago and other large cities. And she has to go to Boise, Idaho, which is still like the most geographically isolated capital city in the country. And save her brother from a crime he didn't commit, which was a murder at the Natatorium. And the twist there, because it's kind of my thing, is Harriet does a good bit of her sleuthing as Harry, because she is a lesbian in 1908. And it's one thing to be that in Chicago, which is, you know, no great shakes. But then she goes to the far west. So I, again, playing with these kind of norms of, you know, a very conservative society, 1908, Boise, Idaho, and you know, here comes Harriet, and, you know, dealing with the Chinese and the Irish, and, you know, they're just kind of interesting things there. So I think my lane is these mysteries, good-hearted characters at the core, but always queer characters.
Did you put in a... how do I say, a subtext or a meaning? Like if someone picks up The Devil's Chew Toy and they bring it home, they read it, below all of the entertainment, Is there some sort of point that you're trying to make?
Yes. And I think it's this. It is, you know, friendships are the most important thing ever. And it was important to me that Hollister and Hayden develop this really strong friendship, even though, like, physically I made them about as different as I could. Personality-wise, I made them as different as I could. But their united, you know, mission of finding this guy that they both like and care about, you know, brought them together. And throughout their time together, almost this kind of forced, you know, crime duo, they come to not only really become really best friends, but also just really love each other and look out for one another. And so it's really like these unexpected friendships and being open to them. And that really is, to me, hopefully that comes through in the book, but at least that was my intention as the theme, because hopefully, you know, when you read the last line of the book, you think, oh, that was fun. You know, I mean, nobody's winning a Pulitzer Prize here with this thing. And, you know, it's very frothy. It's very fast paced. I hope you have fun. But at the end, I hope you think, wow, I like those characters. And I love the fact that they're such good friends, even though they're completely different people. And that's great. Because, you know, those are the kind of friendships I want. You know, I mean, a lot of our friends are very much like us. You know, you find yourself like going out to dinner and you all kind of have the same hue of clothing and the same vibe and all that. But it's, you know, in this divisive world, and I don't mean to make more of a statement out of the book and its mission than, you know, I don't mean to overstate it, but, you know, it's like, can't we all just kind of get along kind of thing? And so, you know, the black butch lesbian and the little ginger pocket gay become the crime fighting duo. And in doing so, become lifelong friends.
How do you sit and write? Like, what's your process? So when Rob is going to put the book together, he's decided he's going to write a book. You sit down, you have some of the ideas. What do you, can you plan your time? Like, I'm going to write 9 to 4 today and do it all like that? Or do you have to be in a certain mood?
No, I usually will just... If I've got a day part, I usually think it's like I'm either going to like have the morning or the afternoon. And just depending on what else is going on in life, I'll try to, you know, kind of dedicate one of the day parts to writing. And depending on where I am in the kind of in the process, if I'm just starting out, I usually will just like on a notepad, scribble out the characters and kind of, you know, what their role in the story is. If I'm actually writing, the one thing I do try to do is just because it drives me crazy if I stop short of a chapter, I try in each kind of day part, again, an afternoon or morning, I try to get through at least a draft, a rough draft on the screen of an entire chapter. Of course, you know, I'm writing in this genre where, you know, the chapters are pretty short. They're not thriller like chapters, which tend to be even shorter, sometimes a page, but you know, they're usually about seven pages, 6 to 7 pages, sometimes 5, but usually 6 to 7 pages. And I try to get the draft to that point.
You know, I'm curious about this. It's a question I've been thinking about a lot myself, Rob, but what initially attracts you to the mystery story? Like, I'm not really talking about cozy or something like subgenre questions. We're like, what about the structure of a mystery story? Do you feel like, you know, it speaks to you? You know, it certainly has always spoken to me. And I find myself, even if I'm writing something that's not necessarily with the big label mystery, it's still structurally, there's a mystery there, you know? So I'm curious, what has drawn you to it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can remember like having chicken pox. I'll make this relevant. As I think I was like in 5th or 6th grade, and my mom started reading Agatha Christie novels to me. You know, I could read myself at that point, but you know, it was like I was 6, so you know, that was kind of like a treat. And I immediately, I just love, love, love the puzzle, right? Because when done well, and I'm not comparing myself to Agatha Christie, by the way, in this, I'm just, you know, when they're done well, you know, you have all of the clues. They were all there. They were all, you know, subtly there, put in the right moments, in the right chapters, said by the right characters, dropped at the right time. And it's this, and then when you get to the moment of the reveal, right, the magic when well done is you go, ah, I should have seen that coming. It was all there for me. I just love that puzzle. And also just the crime, you know, because you've got a crime, that element itself, and I don't think it always has to be a murder. In fact, you know, nobody gets murdered in Devil's Chew Toy. But, you know, that... You know, we love, you know, humans love crime shows because there's so much excitement and drama. And immediately, you know, if there's a crime, you've got a villain and you've got a victim. And so you've got those ready-made elements for tension and there's places to go and things to do. So I've always, for me, I guess just being a little kid, that was kind of my go-to favorite genre. That said, you know, I'll read nonfiction and literary fiction, but, to change it up sometimes. I've got some favorite authors in those categories, but, you know, I just love the puzzle of where is this going and, you know, what happened?
It's interesting because I do have, friends, writer friends who do not think they don't sort of have their imagination is very different. They don't have that sort of structure, that desire. They see it much more as they're more interested in, I guess, I think we're all interested in character psychology, like the why. I think still is very it's certainly from my standpoint drives me as a writer, but they don't think structurally like a mystery. They don't think about clues called gelling together to sort of, you know, give you that whole picture. And I think it's just interesting to see or hear what other authors think, like why they might choose that. I mean, I think a lot of us had early experiences with Agatha Christie. That's a theme. She was actually, I still think, a kind of an important like middle school read for so many writers, particularly crime writers in my generation. But I was just curious. Yeah, I think it's certainly... The way our minds work is just a little different than some other writers. So,
yeah. And it's, you know, you can be tricky. I mean, I'll give you a shout out here for, you know, the Savage Kind, which I really, really, really liked, as I think you know. But, you know, you have all these different characters, like, you know, Miss M, you know, the English teacher, mentor to the girls. I'll try not to be careful not to give any spoilers. You know, it's like that's you know, one character, you know, and she's not the one of the two main characters, but you're like all the while I'm like, all right, what's up with her, you know? I mean, she's like, there's something going on with her that I know is really meaningful, more meaningful than just the way she's presented on the page and, you know, like the early chapters. What is it, you know? And so there's these different layers that, you know, when in the hands of a good author such as yourself and others, you know, it makes for a more intriguing read because you have all these different layers and these themes and you're like, oh, what's up with him, what's up with her, what does that mean, you know? And so it keeps the reader guessing, and I find it a challenge to write. And then, you know, a delight to read, you know, those that are well done, because they give you so much. There's so many layers.
Yeah.
I bet you do that. Well, I was going to say, I bet you do that with people you meet too.
Oh, for sure. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's very much a reflection of the human condition.
Yeah, it is. I think even in literary fiction, I think for a good literary fiction, you should be sort of seeing pieces and then get some, by the end of it, understanding of what's going on psychologically. It kind of works like a mystery story. It's just more, you know, it doesn't have to be so much like clues adding up. But I think there is something to it. But it certainly is something I continue to think about as a writer. Yeah. It sounds like you do too.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I wonder if you, do you actually, watch people or people you know and pick up maybe some of their personality traits or behaviors and incorporate it in some of your characters?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I'll return to like the character Della Rupert, who again is the creepy proprietress of the Marvel of a Pet Store, Barkingham Palace, that I was saying, Melissa McCarthy could play her. She is patterned after a childhood friend who shall not be named, but I completely see this person and the way they have a sing-songy voice, and they even use some of those words. It's like, oh, now, darling, now, sugar. And within a minute, they'll use like sugar and darling and sweet pea several times. And I'd almost think like, oh, I'm overdoing it. If I didn't know, no, I'm not. There's a human being who exists like this. And I love these over the top characters. It's like, and I was mentioning After Hours earlier and going like way back in the time machine. Another time machine is like, this is Spinal Tap. Do you remember that, right? With Christopher Guest and Harry Shearer?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And, those mockumentaries, they're so great because, I think it was like Nigel Tufnell or Derek Smalls, those two characters. One was like, yeah, for the amplifier, they're like, yeah, I turn it up to 11.
It's 11, yeah.
It's like, it was just so silly. But I love the silly and the over the top. And some of the characters like Burley and Della, in my mind, literally, I'm like, okay, you can turn these characters, you can turn them up to 11. Just don't go past 11.
Yeah, yeah. And so do you like to interact with fans, readers, people? Do you do social media, website? How do people get a hold of you?
Through social media. I mean, probably like a lot of authors, it's a blessing and a curse. It's awesome because, through Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, naming the platforms we all use, I have been able to connect with readers, and Goodreads is another great one, different Facebook groups, and so I found a lot of readers that way. They found me. I'm on all those channels, also the website. You can contact me through robosler.com. And I love, I love the conferences. This is my debut novel, so I've only been to two. I've actually met John at Malice Domestic and Left Coast Crime. BoucherCon is coming up early next month. I love those because you meet other authors, and everybody is truly so lovely and supportive in this community. You don't really get a sense of like competition that, it's like people are only going to read my book or your book. So, we got to fight it out. It's like, it's just so silly. There's plenty of readers and plenty of great books for everybody. So I love the writing community. I love the readers. I love to hear from them. I'm not a terribly gregarious person. It's like if we're in the elevator, I probably won't say anything. But, if we strike up a conversation, I'm better one-on-one than I am in a crowd.
Yeah. Are you doing TikTok?
No, my one, at the same time, I have like one foray into that because, it's like book talk, you got to be there. And it's like, oh man, it's like I'm on there enough where I kind of, I get what it is. I'm a little generationally limited by that. But I have reached out to a few people, like Aaron's book talk, right? Because I figured out he's a gay guy who reviews books. So, I friended him, sent him a book, and then he did a 15-second video on the book. So I have one moment or one, there. And so, but really, the short answer is no, I'm not active on book talk. If I had a child or a nephew to help me do videos or something, it may be kind of fun, but
Oh, just put on some lipstick and a wild wig and get on there and start dancing.
I know. See, if it's like I need a Hollister in my world to help me do that.
Yeah, it's funny. I just got on TikTok myself because I was like, I just read an article in I want to say the New York Times, but it might have been the New Yorker, about how like TikTok is taking over essentially, like it's going to be the new modality, et cetera, et cetera. In the future, yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, I really have to figure this thing out. Immediately got on. I was like, oh, I don't know. This is too much. But I think you do kind of have to start figuring it out. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Comfortable making videos of yourself.
I lost all my hair when I got on there. Well, so here we are. I'm just wondering now, Rob, what was the pandemic like for you during the writing process? And I mean, did it sort of interfere with your writing? Did all the emotional stress and the weird stuff going on outside of your door in the outside world interfere or stop you from having a creative write?
No, honestly, it really didn't. I found the whole experience to be increasingly depressing. I mean, just in life in general.
Yeah.
Because like me and my longtime partner, I think of like 23 years. I should know the right number of years, 23, 24 years. But like, you know, one thing that we used to do is we'd go to Orange Theory. You familiar with that? Like, it's like aerobics for adults in this year. Anyway, it's group exercise. And we would do that as part of our weekly routine. Well, you know, COVID comes along and shuts that down. You know, going out to dinner with friends, COVID comes along, shuts that down. It became so isolated that, you know, after a while it got really depressing. And I bring up Orange Theory because I can still remember us like trying to do these in-home workouts that like Orange Theory would create and put online. They were really great about doing that. They're still online. You know, and so we would like buy, you know, water jugs, you know, like gallon water jugs in lieu of weights, because you couldn't even buy weights. And if anybody has seen me, John has met me in person, you're like, you'll know that I'm not a weightlifter. So it's like, so the gallon jugs of water, you know, were plenty of weight. But, you know, us like kind of like flailing our arms around with these, you know, water jugs of gallon water jugs during the pandemic, you know, just trying to get some exercise and trying to, you know, stay reasonably fit, and then, you know, not being able to go out to dinner with friends or even, you know, like see friends for months on end. Yeah, like everybody, I'm sure it's like the pandemic was just it emphasized how much. Even if you're like me and you're not gregarious, how much human interaction, and you do need to see people. You know, we're social creatures, wherever you lie on the spectrum. You know, being a loner, or a homebody, or the most gregarious life of the party. You know, we all need human interaction, and I'm just thankful for Brian, my partner, that and our tall gray cat, Andy Action Cat. That, you know, at least I had two other sentient beings, you know, within the walls that I could, you know, interact with. But for writing, you know, I was like, well, I don't got any excuse because there's not, you know, I'm not leaving the house. So yeah. There wasn't a lot of distraction.
Yeah. I just wonder if stressful and things, do you think it seeps into your writing somehow?
No, honestly, it didn't. I don't know if I'm super lucky or if that's common, but I don't know if I'm more, I don't think I'm more disciplined than the average person, but usually when I, you know, when I plop down in front of the computer to like do my day part, and sometimes it's, you know, both morning and afternoon, but I can pretty much just kind of lose myself in the characters and the story and the setting and go about my business. In many ways, it's such an interesting line of questions. It's kind of an escape from the isolation, you know, because it's somewhere I can go and not, and during those few hours, not be thinking about, you know, the fact that, you know, we can't do all this stuff that we used to do, and that people are getting sick, and that, you know, emergency rooms and, you know, healthcare providers, you know, in when it was really, 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 you know, in the throes of the pandemic, you know, this totally oppressing, upsetting people's lives, getting sick, not to mention, you know, people dying, you know, it was a place to go and escape. I would go, you know, take an adventure with Hollister and Hayden in Seattle for a couple hours.
Hmm. Well, thank God we had Donald Trump telling us to drink bleach.
Oh my God.
Hey, Jane Fonda's got a new workout video for you.
She does? You
know, yeah, she just released it today, 85 years old.
She's awesome.
Her.
Yeah, yeah, she's got a new line of workout clothes as well. So there you go. We're ready for another round of COVID.
Don't say it.
Don't say it, yeah. Well, we're ready for the monkeypox. Yeah. Well, it's been a good conversation. You're a very interesting man, and good luck on your book. It's called The Devil's Chew Toy, a novel, and the writer has been our guest, Mr. Rob Osler. Thank you for being here.
Al, John, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you guys, talk about my book.
Thanks, Rob.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.